Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Dr. Kaelin Davenport, Senior Lecturer in Roman History at Macquarie University and Humboldt Research Fellow at Goethe University in Frankfurt, Germany. This is episode CXXXIX, A Fish in a Net. When Alexander Severus leads the Roman armies east, he meets Artaxerxes and the Sasanians in battle, but he is ultimately unprepared. Artaxerxes attacked unexpectedly with his entire force and trapped the Romans like a fish in a net. Firing their arrows from all sides at the encircled soldiers, the Persians massacred the whole army. Here's Kaelin Davenport.
So how old would he have been at this time then? This is 231.
Yeah, Alexander would be 23 at this point in time. So he's young, but, you know, he's old enough to command an army. And this is what, you know, Roman emperors are supposed to do.
Yeah.
And so there's this expectation that he needs to be there in person to defend the empire, just as Marcus Aurelius had done with the incursions on the Rhine and Danube frontiers.
So he gives his troops a rousing speech, which is always good, which is what you want from an emperor. And we've got Herodian quoting him here.
Yes, so he addresses the soldiers as his fellow men. According to Herodian, he stands up and says, and this is 6.3.3, "Fellow soldiers, I would have preferred to make the usual kind of speech to which you would be a credit to my ability as a speaker and a pleasure for you to listen to. After enduring peace for many years, you may possibly be astounded to hear something novel on this occasion coming unexpectedly in my speech. But brave and balanced men must hope for the best while taking what comes." So the idea that, you know, he can rise to this challenge. He then goes on to say in 6.3.6, "We must not hesitate or falter. Those of you who are more senior, remember the many triumphs you won against the barbarians under Severus or Antoninus, my father." So that's Caracalla. "And you in the prime of your youth who are longing to win fame and glory, show them that although you can be gentle and respectful in keeping the peace, you are successful and brave in war if that is what necessity demands." So Herodian puts this speech into the mouth of the young Alexander. And there's this wonderful scene where the army cheers him. He gives them money. He goes and tells the Senate what is happening. And then the whole Senate and the people come out to wave him off. And he keeps on looking back with tears in his eyes. You know, it's the scene of this young man who knows nothing with peace but peace and now has to go off to war.
Again, my translation is slightly different. He leaves Rome and is weeping and repeatedly looking back at the city, which makes it sound like as soon as the camera's off, he's just in a flood of tears, at the fact that he's got to go and fight a battle. And he's
I think it's sort of, you know, trying to bring up the idea that he's been forced by necessity. That's not his mild nature to do that, but he has to do so.
That's interesting because I took all of this as Herodian showing how inadequate he is for war. So I took that as slightly differently.
I think you're right. And one of the themes that comes up in Herodian is Alexander's lack of andrea, which is roughly the Greek equivalent of virtus. So his lack of bravery and courage, and particularly his dependence on his mother. It's quite interesting that even though this speech is, of course, creation of Herodian, a medallion was created in 231 to commemorate the setting out for war. And the obverse, the headside, features facing busts of Severus Alexander and his mother, Julia Mamia, because they went to war together.
He took his mum to war.
Yep, she went with him. Just like Julia Domna had done with Caracalla.
Yep, mother of the army, that's right.
That's right, yes. The reverse of the medallion shows Severus Alexander addressing the troops. This is the scene of ad locutio, as the Latin says. That's basically a speech or address. So although the scene has been elaborated and interpreted by Herodian, there clearly was an event in which they departed and which was commemorated.
If we were just to rely on Herodian, it does seem to be slightly shambolic and very poorly planned and just a gather up the troops and go.
Yes.
But if you look beyond that, there is evidence that there was a carefully planned campaign here, isn't there?
Yes, and this is when the evidence of inscriptions and papyri particularly comes into its own, because we can actually see rather detailed preparations for the campaign. So Herodian does tell us that there was recruitment in Italy to support the legions, but we also know from inscriptional evidence of senators sent out to enlist the youth of Italy as well. There were also local levies undertaken in Asia Minor. So, of course, Asia Minor, modern-day Turkey, is very close to the frontier.
We
have an inscription which records that an athlete called Lucius Septimius Flavianus Flavilianus actually recruited young men from his city to participate in the war. So we get the sense that different parts of the empire are coming together. We know that there were vexillations or detachments from the armies stationed along the Danubian frontier who were sent to the front. And we know that an equestrian official called Publius Sallustius Sempronius Victor was given a special commission to clear the sea in the eastern Mediterranean of pirates to ensure the provisioning of the troops in Asia Minor.
So to make sure that there was no disruption to any of the lines or anything.
Exactly. We know that the prefect of Egypt at this time obtained some special military functions because he is given an additional title of Stratolates, which means general, but it's a way of expressing generalship which hadn't been attested for a long time. It's actually quite an old word attested in Athenian drama of the 5th century BC. But at this point, it comes back into play to signal that a prefect or other official has a military command function. We know that he is accompanied not only by his mother, Julia Mamia, and the Praetorian prefect. We don't quite know who that is. It could be an equestrian called Domitius Honoratus. He has two leading senators as his comites or official companions. And we know that the governors of the provinces in the east become commanders in the army as well. Lucius Rutilius Pudens Crispinus, who is the legate of Syria Phoenici, is also attested at Palmyra as commanding vexillations in the campaign. So we have a field army building up for this specific campaign, which is structured around the Second Parthian Legion. And this is the legion that Septimius Severus had founded and then stationed at Albanum near Rome.
Mm-hmm.
So this goes with the emperor and the Praetorian prefect. And then the army is made up of vexillations, detachments from other legions along the Danube frontier and along the eastern frontier from Syria. And then we have the levies of local people to help make up the numbers, the auxiliary troops. So we're probably talking about 80 to 90,000, because that's about the same amount that Caracalla had for his Parthian War.
Yeah.
So we're probably looking at an army of a similar scale. So I present all that detail to show what historians can do when we look at all the evidence for inscriptions and papyri. We can actually see that there's a very complex war effort being put together here.
Yeah, fantastic, because all that detail is left out of Herodian.
Exactly. And we don't know whether we can actually say Severus Alexander himself did that, but we can say the administration, the regime, did that.
Yeah, okay. And look, he probably didn't do that.
Yes,
really.
Yes,
honestly,
exactly, yes.
He doesn't strike me as a that kind of details person. But, you know, you're only as good as the men you lead. So what Herodian does give us is the narrative.
Yes.
So we know that he's leaving in Rome in 231 and he comes to Antioch by the summer, which is a good staging ground, I suppose, for these kind of operations.
Definitely.
We've seen that with, I'm going to go like this and you're going to go Lucius
Verus. Yes.
There we go. Lucius Verus used this as a staging.
Yes.
Reached it at a much more leisurely pace, I assume.
Yes. Stopping off at some pleasure resorts on the way.
Severus Alexander gets there in the summer.
Yes.
And from here, he amasses all his troops and he writes another letter asking for peace.
Yes. And Dacia doesn't take too kindly to this, but he's willing to hear him out and sends 400 men, all dressed up to the nines, to demand territory from Alexander. Alexander arrests them but does not execute them. So it's clearly that his army wants to make war against Ardashir, but as a mild and peaceful prince, he doesn't want to execute the embassies.
So how badly does the army want to make war then?
Well, the demands of Ardashir are quite unreasonable. He asked Alexander to abandon Syria and all of Asia Minor, so that they could extend all the way through to the Aegean Sea, for example. And of course, that's something that the Romans were never going to stand for. But there is a mutiny at this time. According to Herodian, Alexander punishes them, but it's clear that the army wants to move forward and attack Ardashir in order to exact for revenge for the invasion of Roman territory.
Mm.
It's quite difficult to work out what's going on between Herodian, Cassius Dio, and the Historia Augusta, all of whom attest various revolts happening under Severus Alexander, particularly in the eastern provinces. We don't quite know when they all take place because they're attested at different times.
But can we kind of take it that this sort of thing is happening, even if we don't know that? Okay,
yes,
so
yeah.
The army is revolting. Not in that way, but trying to overthrow or at least establish their own leadership.
And this is what becomes more common throughout the 3rd century, is that armies who are unhappy with their present commander try and find someone else who will take their place.
Mm-hmm.
But Alexander manages to hold on for the time being, and after consulting with his advisors again, so you do get the sense of the council who's there, he divides his army into three parts. It's really interesting there because the three-pronged strategy is actually identical to that employed by Septimius Severus in his first Parthian War.
Really?
So scholars have thought, well, maybe Herodian has read Dio and is basically taking the same strategy. Or it could just be that Romans decided to pursue a similar strategy in a similar war.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes sense that the army would be divided into three parts. We have an army of 90,000. That's about 30,000 each, which is very substantial.
Yeah.
And Herodian actually says that it's a good strategy, but Severus Alexander is brought down by Tyche, that is chance or fortune. So it's luck on this occasion which brings him down.
Okay.
Sorry, I was going to recount the strategy next.
So I know what's coming, and I wouldn't say that that's luck. I'm disagreeing with Herodian.
Well, that is a key driving force in Greek historiography, going all the way back to Polybius, that some things just happen because of luck.
All right.
Or bad fortune. So there's one army which is sent north to go to Armenia, which of course is that buffer state between the Sasanians and the Romans. The second is sent eastwards to the Tigris and the Euphrates. And the third, Severus Alexander, leads himself, probably intended to go to Hatra in Mesopotamia. We know from an inscription that Severus Alexander is attested at Palmyra, which suggests that Hatra was his ultimate aim there.
Okay, so three prongs and leading one himself is on the surface quite a sound tactic. You keep the enemy distracted. They don't know where you're coming from. And this is textbook outflanking, I suppose.
Yes, yes. And it's a very strong army which has been brought together.
Mm.
So the army that goes through Armenia to the north is attested crossing the mountains in the summer of AD 232, and it is very successful. So they ambush the Medes who live in that area, and the Persian king cannot stop their advance. However, the army which had been sent through to the Tigris and the Euphrates faced very strong resistance. Herodian says they were undisciplined and not advancing properly, and they actually thought that this wasn't a problem because Alexander and his army in the central section would have been successful.
Oh, so they were expecting support.
Yeah, expecting support, yeah. Yes. However, we know this was not the case. So we know from inscriptions Alexander made it as far as Palmyra. We know he was there with the vexillationary commander Rutilius Pudens Crispinus, who was an experienced general. But he didn't go any further. Herodian is at a loss. So he says in Herodian Book 6, Section 5, Subsection 8 to 9, but Alexander failed them by not invading with his army. And this is the section of the army that expected support from him. Perhaps it was due to fear. No doubt he wanted to avoid risking his own life and limb for the Roman Empire. Or his mother may have restrained him because of her womanly timidity and excessive love for her son. She used to blunt Alexander's efforts to behave bravely by convincing him that it was other people's job to take risks for him, not his to get involved in the battle. It was this which brought about the end of the invading Roman army. The Persian king attacked the army with his entire force, catching them by surprise and surrounding them in a trap. So the Romans had to retreat. It was a terrible defeat. Herodian says in 6.5.10, "This terrible disaster, which no one likes to remember, was a setback to the Romans, since a vast army, matching anything in earlier generations for courage and toughness, had been destroyed." According to Herodian, Alexander wasn't even in the battle. He was ill, either from melancholia or lack of acclimatization to the atmosphere, Herodian says, but the troops were not happy. They travelled back to Antioch as a ragtag band to try and lick their wounds.
So while the army was divided into three and one third essentially didn't engage in fighting and were left in Palmyra with Alexander Severus, the other two prongs, when they were engaged and essentially defeated, had to go back home and go, "Where were you? We were waiting for you." And the northern prong had to go back through the mountain pass during winter.
That's right, and that was a disastrous retreat. I mean, remember that section of the army had actually been successful.
Successful until they had to retreat and mostly died along the way.
Exactly, so frostbite, yeah. You know, the wintry conditions.
There's a reason that you don't fight during winter.
Exactly, yeah. And they had crossed the paths during summer and it was going very well.
Yeah, these soldiers just feel even more disenchanted and let down and betrayed,
yes,
by the emperor.
Very much so. And whoever's making decisions here, they're clearly the wrong ones.
But fortunately for them, I guess, and for Severus Alexander, Ardashir disbands his army.
Yes. So he's won victories. He decides to not press any further. This is not the end of the story between Rome and the Sasanian by any means, but it was enough to reach a stalemate.
But essentially, for the Sasanians, it is very much a method of fighting that they have where all of their men will go along to fight, and it's not sustainable long-term because they don't supply their troops properly, and so the men need to go back and tend to the crops and the agriculture and what have you.
Yes.
So, yeah.
It's essentially what Rome used to be like. You know, instead of a citizen army, there wouldn't be citizens in the same way. But yes, it's the people, you know, till the land. They also fight in warfare, whereas Rome essentially now has quite a different structure, professional soldiers.
Fortunately for Severus Alexander, because if they pressed the point, Ardashir probably would have won even more against him.
It could have gone disastrously wrong.
More than it did,
yes.
How did Severus Alexander take this then? He would have had a very disappointed army with him, but the battle would have been over, I guess.
Yes, and Herodian talks about him regaining his strength and his happiness. Again, this fits into the portrayal of the young man who's not suited for warfare. There were probably plans for Severus Alexander and Julia Mamia to visit Egypt. We know from papyri in the Arsinoite Nome, pigs were being brought together, part of the preparations for the imperial visit, but that didn't happen. Instead, they returned to Rome, where Severus Alexander celebrated a triumph.
Wow, yes. That's brave.
Yes.
It's a brave man to call that a victory.
Well, they didn't invade any further, so, you know, they're masters at political manipulation.
See, I can just see the army getting angrier and angrier about this.
I think we can definitely attest that there would be a resentment within large sections of the troops.
And there's a slave behind Severus Alexander in the chariot holding a laurel wreath going, "You are an ordinary man, a really, really ordinary man." Did they still do that then?
Oh, well, yes, the emperor's now, so. poor Severus Alexander, I mean, you know.
An absolutely ordinary man.
I have some sympathy for him, you know. It can't be easy to have to live up to people like Septimius Severus.
Well, true, true.
You know, he didn't want to be king. Yes, it's interesting that in Herodian, they don't go back to Rome. He has Severus Alexander immediately being summoned to the German frontier.
But we do have proof of this triumph.
We do know from the coins that are created.
Yeah.
The historian Augusta gets it right and says he went back to Rome. There are coins showing Severus Alexander giving his fifth imperial congiarium or handout to the citizens. And there's a medallion in which he is shown standing above the Tigris and Euphrates rivers to symbolize his victory over the Sasanian Persians. It's quite interesting that the image of Severus Alexander is quite different in the Historia Augusta compared to Herodian. Mm. And Severus Alexander, he actively fights in battle. So this is part of the image of the ideal prince who succeeds in both civilian administration and in military affairs.
Wow, so not even just hiding behind the sidelines in Palmyra, just actively swinging a sword himself, does it?
Exactly, wow. Yes. Yeah, he constantly commanded the flanks, the Historia Augusta says. And this is at least partially because not much is known of Severus Alexander's reign. The sources are difficult to untangle, but we know they still read Herodian in late antiquity. There's clear evidence that Ammianus Marcellinus, the late Roman historian, had read Herodian, and some of his own descriptions of battles are based on Herodians. So there are clearly two different traditions about Severus Alexander in circulation in the 4th century.
Mm. So even though we do know that he heads back to Rome, he can't exactly rest on his laurels.
Definitely not, because there are now problems brewing on the northern frontier, which is going to force Severus Alexander to take to the front again.
That's Dr. Kaelin Davenport, Senior Lecturer in Roman History at Macquarie University and Humboldt Research Fellow at Goethe University in Frankfurt, Germany. And you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe to it in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you may cast your pod. Please leave a review. They are always as appreciated. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow both myself and Kaelin on Twitter. Kaelin is at Dr. C. Davenport, I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. In the next episode of Emperors of Rome, Severus Alexander takes the army north to confront the Germans, but he soon finds he doesn't have the backing of his own troops. So until then, I'm Matt Smith, you've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.